is to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. For almost 15 years, we've shared our lives, our intimate personal histories, our goofy jokes, embarrassing videos, plus the names of everyone we know and love, with Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, and all the rest. And in return, they've abused our privacy and trust over and over and over. So maybe it's time to consider a divorce. Meet our digital producer, Mark Rickers. Mark, have you ever tried to get off Facebook?
Unsuccessfully. I signed up for a Facebook account in 2005, basically as early as I could possibly have one.
Can we look at some of your old Facebook posts?
Yeah.
Who is that? Is that you?
That is me without a beard. Dumb little inside jokes and embarrassing photos that I'm very, very fortunate that no employer has ever found in the course of interviewing me.
Wait, who just said I pooped green in your bed?
Yeah, I don't know. I was definitely living in a house full of dudes. That embarrassing information that I was barely okay with floating on the web to begin with is being used to build psychographic profiles of me and everyone I've ever known. I have a friend who's sending me messages every day saying, like, I deleted my account and you should too. And that made me think, well, maybe it really is that bad. It's that big. All of us are going to delete our accounts in some way.
What happens when you decide to delete your Facebook life? How did it go?
Well, there is a delete button. I was actually skeptical that there would be one. But when you get to the delete account screen, there's a lot of scary language about how permanent it is. You have 4,000 photos, you have 1,800 posts, and it will take days for it to actually delete everything.
Days?
Yeah. There's a lot of technical hurdles in doing something like that. This was actually right around the time that Lori and I started dating.
And now you're married.
Yeah. So I decided then maybe deleting the account wasn't good for me, but I could at least delete all the information they had on me. The pre-2018 mark. Turns out that is considerably harder than deleting your account.
Why?
Because the only way to do it is post by post by post by post by post.
So Mark comes to Lord of the Rings marathon over break. I like young Mark Rickers.
2018 Mark quite dislikes Lord of the Rings.
Even once you began to delete all your posts, you still exist through all your friends' posts.
Mm-hmm. Unless you can get everybody you ever knew to delete everything they ever did on Facebook, you will still exist in some form. You know, I have a friend who, they had their first child this year, and am I going to ask him to change how he's posting about his kid because I'm uncomfortable with logging into Facebook to see it? You get to a certain point where you'll take any connective tissue you can get.
So have you gone back to Facebook now?
I've fully relapsed.
Oh, no. It's like a bad relationship. Can't live with you, can't live without you, Facebook. This seems to be where we all are with social media. Although digital insiders like Mark are maybe the most conflicted. In Silicon Valley, the birthplace of the internet, parents are reportedly kicking their own kids off social media. And Jaron Lanier, the visionary computer scientist who helped build the internet and invent virtual reality, thinks we should all delete our social media accounts. Right now. Steve Paulson wondered, all of them?
Jaron, let me start out by asking about your own digital footprint. You are not on Facebook or Twitter or any other social media platform, right?
That's right.
And you don't have any hidden anonymous accounts?
Oh, no. I mean, there was a time when some of my cats would get accounts just so I could kind of keep up with what's going on. But it really seems beside the point at this time. So you can live a full life and you can even write books and promote them without being on social media.
So you are a very active user of the internet, but just specifically social media, you stay away from that.
What I stay away from is extremely specific. It's the behind-the-scenes manipulative algorithms that measure people and put them in a Skinner box by creating personalized feeds that are engineered by algorithm to modify those people for the benefit of third parties who are sneaky and often unseen. That is the thing I avoid. Not only am I an active internet user, I really like the internet. I mean, I was the chief scientist of Internet 2, the main academic consortium figuring out how to scale the internet in the 90s. I've put a lot of effort into the internet. I continue to. I kind of love the internet, but the manipulation engine is the thing that I think is very much worth avoiding, and it's also very avoidable.
So when you talk about the manipulation engine, are you talking about specific companies like Facebook and Twitter and I suppose Google as well?
Yeah. So what happened was when those companies were being founded, let's say from when Google was founded to when Facebook was founded, there was this very strong wave of idealism in the tech world that everything should be free. Nobody should be excluded. An exemplary design like that might be the Wikipedia. Everybody's a volunteer. And there was a lot of feeling that that would be the best way forward for society. But we had to reconcile that with this other thing that we also loved, which was these larger-than-life entrepreneurs and hackers who could dent the universe, as Steve Jobs put it, these creatures with extraordinary ability to change the course of history through their creativity and force of will. And so if you love entrepreneurs, but you want everything to be free, there's only one way to get both at once, which is with the advertising model where things look free, but actually there's somebody to the side putting money in. And as long as that's sort of a low-tech thing, as it was at the start, it's kind of not a problem. But everything's gotten accelerated. The computers have gotten much bigger. The algorithms have gotten better. The people who use the system have become more sophisticated. And what started out as advertising has turned into something sinister. And, you know, I have a really easy measure for whether something online is part of this manipulation machine or not. And that is, did Putin's psych warfare units use it. So if Putin wasn't there, it's probably okay. So Putin was all over Facebook, Google and YouTube, Reddit, Twitter, of course. And so that's a pretty indication that those things are subsumed by the manipulation model, which I think we must learn to overcome.
Hmm. So you have come up with 10 arguments for why you think we should delete our social media accounts. And let's talk about a few of them. For starters, they are addictive. And you say the founders of Facebook actually knew this very early on, that their algorithms were designed to get people addicted to the next click, the next dopamine hit, and all of that.
This is a question that fascinates me. So Sean Parker, who's the first president of Facebook, has said that they deliberately used addictive techniques similar to the techniques that gambling businesses use to get people addicted to gambling. Now, here's the thing. I used to know Sean Parker, and I knew him socially during the time when Facebook was nascent. And I don't think he knew. You know, like I kind of wonder if maybe Sean is kind of remembering himself as more of a Bond villain than he really was. Because based on my direct experience of the people involved at the time, I believe this was more of a terrible mistake we all fell into rather than a deliberate plan.
So what exactly makes Facebook so addictive?
This is based on the science of behaviorism, which started in the 19th century. The brain is fascinated by the world. The brain is looking for patterns. The brain is always trying to uncover that extra hidden layer. And so if you give feedback that isn't perfect, that has unpredictable timing, that has an element of noise to it, the brain actually latches onto it and becomes ever more entranced with the possibility that more could be understood.
The example of that would be you post something and, you know, you get feedback. You get likes or comments or whatever, and that's the hit.
Yeah. And so the algorithms are watching you. There's an enormous amount of information of an ever widening variety that can include things like your gait, meaning the way you walk, your facial expressions, certainly who you know, what you buy, where you go, all kinds of things. The personalized feed or the ads or whatever it might be, all these things are adjusted to increase. The term of art is engagement, but that's really just what we call addiction.
On the other hand, all those people like me who do use Facebook, it's very easy to stay in touch with people. Or for someone like me in the media to get the word out about some of the projects I'm doing, it seems very useful in a lot of ways.
Well, look, I also have to say that people in the media are some of the worst addicts. I see reporters checking.
Oh, that's absolutely true. You're right.
No, you guys, you're checking your Twitter feeds constantly in this way that's just insane. You have a problem that you need to address, honestly. Twitter addiction is destroying a lot of people's lives. It's destroyed Trump's character. It's recently destroyed Elon Musk's and caused his stock to suffer. But it's destroying journalism because so many journalists are so addicted to this quick feedback loop that it degrades your sensibility. So I'm sorry to turn – I don't mean to make this about you. I know I'm the one being interviewed. Yeah. But when I hear –
I kind of agree with you on this.
All right. I don't know that it's harder than getting people to stop smoking in public places. I mean, that was – those who aren't old enough to remember might have a hard time grasping how difficult that is. Nicotine is profoundly addictive, and it was profoundly normalized, where every movie and every television show showed people smoking everywhere, and it was considered sort of weird not to smoke. But somehow we got through that. Somehow it changed.
Hmm. So we've been talking a lot about the idealism of the early tech revolution in comparison to what it's become now when money is so dominant. And it seems like one of the huge ironies is that we hear that a lot of the top executives of the big tech companies, Facebook, Microsoft, so on, apparently are very strict about limiting the screen time of their own kids.
Yeah. You know, I live in Berkeley, which is kind of at the edge of what you might properly call the tech community, which is more in Silicon Valley itself and in San Francisco these days. But even so, my daughter's friends have parents who work at companies like Google and Facebook routinely. And I think we're more liberal with letting her use devices as she wishes and letting her learn her own lessons than they are. What I've seen, and this is widely reported, is that the engineers and executives at these companies are incredibly strict with their kids, and there tend to be a lot of kids in Waldorf schools or sort of supernatural schools. And sometimes when I visit the homes of parents of my daughter's friends, we'll be asked to turn our phones off. Like, it's a real Luddite environment, even though there's this beautiful house that was paid for by the tech industry.
So I want to step back for a bit, because what makes your argument so fascinating is your own personal history. I mean, you were one of the early pioneers of all this new digital technology we've been talking about, one of those tech entrepreneurs, hackers who helped create the culture that we now call Silicon Valley. You're partly to blame for all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I think it's important for Silicon Valley people to recognize that. I will accept my portion of blame. Although that said, I have to say that I was one of the earliest critics of this stuff. I was writing about how we were making a mistake as early as 92, as were a few others, sometimes at great personal cost because I lost friends over it. People thought I was betraying our common goal. But despite that, I absolutely do share blame.
I know you had a pretty difficult childhood. Your mother died early when you were 10. You lived for a while in the desert with your dad, practically off the grid. You were bullied at school. You seem to be the classic case of the kid who didn't fit in. And I guess I'm wondering if that's, I know this sort of, it's cheap psychology here, but is that partly what led you into your fascination with technology?
Well, as difficult as my childhood was, which is mostly about my mother dying in a car accident when I was small, we should keep some perspective here. I did have a difficult childhood. On the other hand, my mother survived being in a concentration camp, and today our government is wrenching children away from their parents, never to be seen again. So compared to either of those, my childhood was not that difficult. I mean, to me, technology was about connecting with other people. I felt so isolated after my mom died that I wondered how I could ever connect with other people. I felt very alone. And so I imagined virtual reality as this thing where people would be together in this world that could be fantastical, that could convey some of these experiences that you didn't know how to put into words that you couldn't otherwise share. And I still think it can be that. I still think it's most beautiful when it functions in that way, although that's rare. I mean, look, this cuts to something that I think is really important, which is to me, criticism or complaint is the face. It's the expression of optimism because the person who's the critic is the one who believes that things can be better in the future. The complacent person is the person who's the enemy of the future. It's the complacent person who is the true pessimist. So I view these criticisms as an act of optimism.
Thank you.
Jaron Lanier, talking with Steve Paulson. Jaron's a senior scientist at Microsoft, and you can read more of his criticisms in his book, 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media, right now.
So I actually agree with Jaron on a lot of things. In many ways, I think his vision isn't nearly radical enough.
Ethan Zuckerman directs the Center for Civic Media at MIT.
I'm really tired of the negativity without people working on solutions. I think we have to have a really careful conversation about what we think social media could do for us. Just saying, let's delete it and walk away, feels pretty incomplete to me.
And what could social media do for us?
So I wrote an essay a couple of months ago called Six or Seven Things Social Media Could Do for Democracy.
Like what?
You could use social networks to increase diversity. Right now, when you join Facebook, Facebook introduces you to everyone you went to high school with and everyone you went to college with. What if Facebook introduced you to different people? What if it said, hey, you're a liberal, let me introduce you to some smart conservatives who have some common interests. Maybe you're someone who's interested in Brexit, and maybe they want to introduce you to an anti-Brexiteer. What I'm advocating for is that we very self-consciously ask ourselves what sort of public spaces, digital public spaces, we need in a democracy, and then build them.
I'm just sort of thinking that, I mean, you mentioned the Arab Spring, for instance. Seems like not that long ago. We were all talking about that as the Facebook revolution. Social media was going to be the answer to authoritarian censorship because people could organize and protest and news of those protests could spread. But it also enabled Cambridge Analytica so that it can just as easily be just another means for the powerful to manipulate and control the public.
So I've got a great Arab Spring story for you. Wael Ghanim was the founder of the Facebook group We Are All Khaled Said, which was the Facebook group that primarily brought people out into the streets in Tahrir Square. So he was a Google employee, but he was a heavy Facebook user, and he ended up using Facebook to help organize the revolution. And he was a central figure to the point where Mubarak eventually called him up and said, could you please pull your people out of the street? And he said, of course, they're not my people. I can't really do that. After the Mubarak government fell, Wael spent a lot of time trying to figure out whether the opposition could organize on Facebook. And of course, it didn't organize very well, and we ended up with the Muslim Brotherhood and then with a military dictatorship. And so Wael's next act was to build a new social network. He actually created a social network called Parleo. It was designed to be much smaller than Facebook. It was designed to have a very heavy emphasis on politeness and on reasoned discussion. It actually did pretty well. It got off the ground. It got bought by Quora. At the end of the day, you know, the reason that it failed was not really that it didn't work, but that it didn't work fast enough and that it was better to feed another venture capital-backed thing. We've done a dismal job of thinking through how these spaces could work. We've assumed that they're going to be corporate run. We've assumed that they're going to be ad supported. And we've assumed that they're going to involve billions of people and that they're failures if they don't involve billions of people.
One thing you're saying, seems like, is that rather than needing less social media, we need more. Many more platforms, many more companies.
Well, you're right that I'm asking for social media to become massively plural, but I'm also asking it to be both public in spirit and possibly in financing. This is a hard sell in the United States. We're not very good at doing public goods in this country. But I think it'd be really interesting if you had local governments starting this up. I'd literally like to see public media providers thinking about how could they build social media spaces that end up being conversational spaces between people who don't talk to each other in the real world?
I love that. I know that you've written that one solution might be the public broadcasting model, so we'd have public social media. Play that out. Like, what do you imagine besides more pledge drives and tote bags?
There's enormous work that could be done really around two things. One is deliberation. How would you get people who disagree on different subjects to enter into a real conversation and actually hear each other's point of view? You could certainly also work on diversity. Could you build a social network whose goal is to introduce you to your neighbors who you don't know, or to introduce you to other people in the country whose perspectives you might not be hearing from?
Could you really do that? Like, how would that work?
So in many ways, what I'm proposing is much like the old-fashioned web browser. Imagine what would have happened to the web if to go to every different website, you had to download a different piece of software. That's how social media works right now. Facebook's client works with Facebook. Doesn't work with WhatsApp or Instagram, two platforms that they own. Those are completely separate experiences. We took an early crack at this in my lab. It's called Gobo. You can go to gobo.social. And we have a client that will let you look at Twitter and Facebook pages, and you can actually control how they're presented to you. If you, like me, worries that you're hearing from too many white men, you can actually change the gender ratio on your feed. We have a gender slider. You can hear from more women. We have a mute all men button. That one's very popular. We have a mute brands button so that if you feel like you're hearing too many corporate messages or NGO messages. And really what this is a vision for how I'd like to see the web work. I'd like us to have a client that could interact with dozens, hundreds, thousands of networks. And I would like you as the user to have control over it. But this is what I mean about the ambition. If we just say, hey, Facebook, we're not going to take it anymore, we're going away, that's only a partial protest. I think a much better form of protest is to start building the world we want and to see if we can get Facebook to catch up with the rest of us. And if not, we'll just build a better world.
Hmm. Do you have a wish list for other features you want to develop on Gobo?
What I really would love is a great introduction feature that was trying to find me people who are well outside of what I'm currently paying attention to, but who I might otherwise be interested in. And I think that that sort of engineered serendipity is the kind of thing that we should be demanding from these sorts of tools.
Would you want it to give you some neo-Nazis to meet?
So
I mean,
I don't mean
that as flippantly as it sounds.
Well, and I'll tell you a story behind that. As well as working for MIT, I work for Open Society Foundations, which is George Soros's charity. I'm very open about that work online. I meet a lot of Nazis online. I've actually become friends with some extremists online and actually have a regular Twitter chat with someone who would definitely identify as the alt-right.
What do you talk about?
We occasionally trade barbs at one another, but more than anything, we're trying to figure each other out. He's trying to figure out why I believe what I believe. I'm trying to figure out why he believes what he believes. And honestly, we've been doing it in a very open and respectful fashion. I probably learned more from that relationship over the last 2 years than I have from almost any other relationship in my life.
Ethan, you strike me as fundamentally optimistic about the goodness of human beings in some ways, because what you're suggesting is that given the choice, people would prefer to have a more diverse feed. People would prefer to encounter and engage with more people who are not like them. I would really like to believe that that version of reality is correct, and I think it might be. But, you know, there are people who would say that's ridiculous, that that's not human nature.
I can be just as cynical and dark as the next person. The trick is, if you want a future to happen, you have to believe in it and imagine it enough to try to build it. I just think we're at a moment where we're very heavy on the critical side and not strong enough on the civic imagination side. And what I'm trying to do is get more people to work with me imagining possible futures and starting to build them, because Lord knows we could use the help.
Ethan Zuckerman directs the Center for Civic Media at MIT, and I hope you take him up on his invitation. You can read more about his work on our website at ttbook.org. And in the meantime, want to know what you can do to make social media a better place? We've got an answer coming up. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Deciding what kind of society we want online is a huge project, but it starts so much smaller. It starts with how we behave on Twitter and Facebook. When we share a video to argue over whether a dress is blue or gold, it was blue. When we weigh in with a hot take. When we drop a reaction gif into a conversation for a cheap laugh. The everyday internet is a carnival of memes, and it mostly seems harmless. But is it? Digital culture scholar Whitney Phillips thinks some of the fun we have online could be considered a form of trolling.
Trolling, historically, reaching back into the late 80s, early 90s, it was people accusing others of behaving in an antisocial sort of way.
All your base are belong to us. You are on the way to destruction.
Trolling was something you accused others of doing because they were interrupting conversation, because they were just sort of being disrespectful. Basically a way of saying you are not behaving in a way that is conducive to community formation.
Johnny bit me.
In the early mid-2000s, the term trolling became a point of self-identification for a lot of people associated with the website 4chan. So trolling went from something you accused another person of being to something that you yourself kind of identified as. And the hallmark of that behavior was a kind of detached, playful irony.
Is this real life?
Yeah, this is real life.
Silly behaviors.
Stay in your seat.
Things that you would do to your friends or just others to kind of flabbergast them, but in a way that was sort of funny.
Some people out there in our nation.
You linked them to a particular story.
Don't have that.
And then when they clicked the link, it would take you to the Rickrolling. It might have resulted in some kind of surprise, but it wasn't necessarily hateful. Not everybody thinks the same thing when they hear the word trolling. The term has undergone a number of different shifts over the years.
Leave me alone.
When people use the word trolling to refer to, for example, neo-Nazi behaviors or hate speech, they may not take the behaviors as seriously because trolling, for many, many people, suggests a kind of, I'm not really a racist, I just play one on the internet.
When I say slavery, you say sorry, slavery.
And so it can minimize the very real implications of those kinds of behavior. So to sidestep that confusion, I think it's very helpful to just describe the behaviors for what they do.
You're an orphan now.
Stop saying I look like Chicken Little.
That was Keyboard Cat, Miss South Carolina's concern about maps, David reckoning with real life after a visit to the dentist, and more. If you didn't catch all the references, there's a glossary on our website. The point is, maybe you shared some of those when they first came across your feed. They're good for a laugh. But did it occur to you to think about who you might be hurting in the process? Whitney Phillips says the internet is both playful and mean, and we are not good at telling the difference.
You know, there are certain people who wake up in the morning and make a decision that they are going to antagonize and harm others. But a huge problem is the number of people who kind of behave in ways that result in harm, even if that's not what they think they're doing, even if that's not what they set out to do. It's so easy to accidentally engage in problematic behavior or behavior that could harm directly or indirectly. Even the best of us can potentially fall into that.
Would I have done something like this?
I'm sure you have.
Have you?
I'm sure I have. I mean, the thing is that, have you ever retweeted something?
Yeah.
So have I. And also, so I'll speak just specifically about my own behavior. There have been times when I've jumped into a conversation midstream, not really knowing what the full context was. I have retweeted things in order to criticize or even make fun of them. I have posted memes before in my life. I have posted GIFs before in my life because I wasn't thinking about the person behind the meme. I wasn't thinking about the broader story from which a GIF was plucked. I wasn't thinking about the fact that retweeting a story in order to critique or make fun of that story was going to make that story live longer, that it was going to give it a longer tail.
Let's dig into that a little bit more because let's say my sister sends me on Facebook or something a very funny but quite uncomplimentary little article about Donald Trump. You're saying that together, the two of us are kind of enabling this culture of incivility on the internet?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that civility is sort of a tricky concept. Oftentimes, civility gets used as a way to sort of silent dissenting speech or to silent speech that is someone raises their voice and you say you're being uncivil.
Politeness is often code for shut up and don't bother anybody.
I don't want to listen to your grievance, so be civil.
Yeah.
So it's not civility that I think really is what's lacking online. I think it's ethics. I think it's thinking about the full, broad implications of our everyday behavior. So with the QAnon case, that was the controversy over the summer where, you know, people believed that there was a— it's too complicated to really go into too much detail, but Trump is in on it. And
right.
Basically, all of the Democrats are about to be arrested and thrown into prison for pedophilia rings, like just stuff that's beyond the pale of what's true. So a lot of people on the left, a lot of academics even actually too, spent a lot of their summer posting this apparently sincere QAnon conspiracy theorizing in order to make fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people, sort of moderate conservatives, would be so angered by the sort of liberal impulse to call Trump supporters stupid and crazy and all those derogatory words that then you're just less likely to have moments where you can potentially find common ground. And I'm not saying that you need to like make best friends with Nazis. That's not it at all. But there are people who are actually not too far apart from each other on the ideological spectrum. But because a lot of these behaviors force you to join teams, means that we're not going to be able to connect within the kind of realm of reasonable discourse.
Mm. You remind me of some research I read that said something along the lines of when people engage in social media platforms, politically, what winds up happening is they gradually move to the extremes. The people on the left move further left. People on the right move further right. The center is what goes away.
Mm-hmm. The stuff that floats to the top, the stuff that online platforms privilege, algorithmic docenting is what I call it, those things tend to be the most partisan, the most extremist content. That content is best for social media platforms' business, and it's also best for journalists' business. And so there's lots of reasons why people get pushed into these various silos. And when you get put in those silos, then the other person becomes the enemy, and then you're thinking even less about reaching out. And we end up, for a variety of reasons, not having anything to do with us being bad people, but for a variety of reasons, we just engage in behavior that's not very thoughtful.
Well, frankly, this has me rethinking everything I post or share or comment on. How has this changed your own behavior online?
I say very much less things. No, I mean, really, I believe in democracy and I believe in people raising their voices and contributing. And I think public discourse is important and good and we need it. But I also think that so much of the stuff that we post is just maybe not super necessary. It's not that everything, every GIF, every meme, every silly joke that we post, it's not that it will cause harm. It's that most of the things we do online could potentially. Thinking about that, could this potentially hurt someone? Could this potentially be misinterpreted and dehumanize another person inadvertently? Once you start sort of engaging in that ethical reflectiveness, it gives me certainly more pause about, do I really need to do this?
Well, so for instance, let's say my very outspoken, very funny, very lefty friend posts something, speaking of the Trump administration. They should all be in jail.
Uh-huh.
She means it as a joke. She doesn't literally think they should all be in jail, or at least not all of them. How does that fit into your code of ethics?
I mean, I guess I'm less in the business of sort of judging what other people do and more in the business of encouraging people to ask themselves, do you take full responsibility for this? If somebody decides that they take full responsibility for what they're saying, then the ethical gut check criterion has been met. And really, my concern is with people who post stuff online and then if they face any backlash and they throw their hands up and say, well, I was just joking or I was just trolling. It's like, well, you may have been, but other people online, they can't read your mind and it shouldn't be their job to. So if you're going to say something, stand behind it. Another important question to ask is, what do I not know about this piece of content or about this story? Because often ethically problematic behavior results from not having the full picture. So if you're talking about posting a meme, for example, or a single image or a reaction GIF, do I know if this person gave consent? Do I know how this meme has impacted this person's life? Do I know the full story so that I can make a responsible decision? Our spaces trick us into thinking we don't need to do the kind of ethical reflection we might do in person. And so then making the extra step to just do that. And it doesn't take very long. But I think that change could be cumulative over time.
But it seems like partly what you're saying is that we are all helping to create a certain kind of climate, saying sarcastic, snarky, slightly mean things, even if it's as a joke. What we're doing is kind of enabling more of that. So I get that. But at the same time, so much of humor is snarky and mean, and like that's just funny. I don't want Facebook and Twitter to become humorless.
Oh, and that's not what I'm advocating for at all. But I think that, of course, I don't want there to be an extreme overcorrection to where no one ever tells a joke ever and everything is always very serious. But where we are is dangerous and it's ugly and it is bad for democracy. So continuing to do things exactly as we have collectively done them, that's not quite working in terms of a healthy body politic.
Whitney Phillips is a digital culture scholar at Syracuse University. She's the co-author with Ryan Milner of The Ambivalent Internet: Mischief, Oddity, and Antagonism Online. Okay, so there's a lot that's not working about social media. And the question we're asking this hour is, what do you want to do about it? You could decide to opt out, just delete all your accounts. But frankly, that assumes a certain amount of privilege. Like, maybe you can do without social media if your life is already pretty comfortable. But some people can't wait for something better to come along. They need social media today to talk about what's happening right now, to organize right now, to change the world right now. That's how organizer DeRay McKesson uses his Twitter account anyway.
You know, I always think about Twitter as like the friend that's always awake in so many ways. Twitter really helped me. It helped all of us like have a platform and really push for things and not have to be filtered by mainstream media. So if we had not had Twitter in the early days in St. Louis, for sure, Missouri would have tried to convince you that we didn't exist.
No respect for the property of others. No respect for authority.
Those people aren't real. They're not telling the truth.
He is clearly attempting to incite a riot.
But we actually didn't need the mainstream to listen. We could actually just listen to each other. We can learn things about each other and build community and like learn each other's names and hopes and dreams and fears and purpose and all that stuff online.
We have not done anything.
Now all of a sudden a video can happen on Monday and everybody in the community and the world can see it on Monday. You don't have to wait for the newspaper to write about it. You don't have to wait for the TV news to say it. Like you can just move it along and like force a response from local officials. You think about this latest shooting where the police officer went to somebody's house and shot them. If there had not been social media, like there's no way this story would be in national news. There's no way it'd be moving as quickly.
Give me justice for my son.
But suddenly you get that incident. You get people who live in the building also making videos.
Let me see if my door stays ajar.
Saying this is actually how the doors work.
Nope. Lies.
so really incredible. I've seen the best and worst of Twitter, that you're the first person ever permanently banned from Twitter was banned for raising money to try and get me killed, so I think about that. But I've also seen the good parts of Twitter. You think about the Parkland students, Me Too, March for Our Lives. None of those things would have been possible without Twitter.
Everybody want me to be calm. Do you know how them bullets hit my son?
St. Louis was the beginning of Twitter being a tool in this country for activism. What is so shocking and what's so unsettling about these issues is that we aren't the first people to say it, right? That there's so many people who've said these things way before us. You think about most of the unrest in communities is a result of something that police have done. People have been telling the truth about what's going on in their community for a long time. The question was, like, why weren't people listening? And I think that with Twitter, we actually just didn't need the system to listen. We could actually listen to each other and use that as a way to build power.
Coming up, can we use social media and technology to build a better future together? Historian Yuval Noah Harari uses the past to imagine what we could do. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. It's clearer with every passing day just how much information about us is owned by major corporations. Non-anonymized, personal data about everything from our sex lives to our voting habits is being collected and shared, often without our knowledge or permission. Now, maybe you don't care who knows about your last Amazon purchase or Netflix binge, but if you've taken a genetic ancestry test, your DNA is out there. Do you know who has it? If you wear an Apple Watch, your blood pressure and heart rate could be monitored. Admit it, did you read the terms and conditions? And the algorithms that use all of that information are becoming exponentially more powerful. So what does this mean?
It means, among other things, that an external system can know you far better than you know yourself. It can then predict your choices and decisions. It can manipulate your emotions. And it can sell you anything, whether a product or a politician.
Yuval Noah Harari is the big thinking historian who wrote the bestseller Sapiens. In his latest, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, he warns that whoever owns the data owns the future. He told Steve Paulson it's become the most important resource in the world.
Previously in history, first land and then machines were the most important resource. Now data. Politics is becoming the struggle to control the data flows, and the future belongs to those who manage to monopolize or to own the data.
Okay, well, let me play the cynic for a moment here. So algorithms know us much better than we know ourselves. Actually, they know.
They could know us. We are not there yet, okay. But we can get there.
Right. So you might just think, okay, why not just give ourselves over to the computers? Let them program our lives. Let them make decisions for us. Maybe we'll be happier then.
Well, in some cases, this will actually be a very good idea. In some areas, it's better to trust the algorithms than to trust human beings. It starts with things like trusting who is driving the car. At present, more than 1 million people are killed each year in traffic accidents. That's more than the number of people who die from war and crime and terrorism put together. And almost all these traffic accidents are because of humans making bad decisions. And If we switch and let the algorithms, the computers, drive the vehicles, it won't reduce traffic accidents to zero, but it is likely to save a million lives a year. Already today, we give algorithms more and more authority to decide for us things like which movies to see and which books to buy, and we no longer search for information, we Google.
But there's a big difference between, you know, if we're trying to figure out what movie to see, okay, we look at recommended movies to us, which is obviously the product of an algorithm, but still, we're making the choice based on those recommendations. You're saying this would take it many steps further than that.
As you trust more and more the algorithm, you gradually lose the ability to make the decisions yourself. And then the question is, so what is human life all about? I mean, we have for thousands of years constructed this ideal of human life as a drama of decision-making. Small decisions and big decisions.
This is what our ethical systems are based on. This is, to some degree, what religion is based on. The power of our ability, our capacity to make decisions, good decisions.
Exactly. You make good decisions, you go to heaven. You make bad decisions, you go to hell. And this is, you know, so many, everything from Shakespeare plays to silly Hollywood comedies. It's about these decisions. Whom should I marry? Should I go to war or make peace? All these kinds of decisions. What happens to our notion of humanity if more and more of these decisions are actually taken by algorithms?
There's a politics to all of this. I'm curious about how you see our political moment right now, because it would seem that the dominant political ideology, political system that has come to sort of reign over much of the world, liberal democracy, that seems to be under threat right now.
We are in a very bewildering moment in history because we lack a good story to understand what is happening and where are we heading. The liberal story is based on the ideal and the notion of free will, that the free will of individual humans is the ultimate source of authority in the world. But science is now telling us that there is no such thing as free will. This is just a myth.
There's a lot of debate about that. A lot of scientists, a lot of philosophers are not willing to give up that idea of free will.
As private individuals, maybe. But if you look at the literature, at the scientific journals, at the scientific articles and experiments and so forth, science just doesn't even understand what the meaning of the word freedom is. I mean, the way that the Cambridge Analytica and all these companies and bots behaved is that, first of all, they hacked humans. They got to know what are your existing hatreds and fears and biases. And once you know what are the biases and existing weaknesses of a particular person, you can work on that.
The fears and the hatreds are more primal emotions often. So if you can tap those, then you can really control to some degree the political discourse.
Yes, if you want to destroy the ability to have a meaningful public conversation, then you discover the weaknesses of people, their fears and hatreds and so forth, and you magnify them. So maybe they discover that you have already a built-in bias against immigrants. They will show you a fake news story about an immigrant gang raping local women. And they know that you will believe it very easily because you already have this bias. But your neighbor, she has a very different bias. She is actually in favor of immigration. But her bias is she thinks everybody who opposes immigration is a fascist, racist idiot. So the same group will show her a very different story about, I don't know, a gang of right-wing fanatics who kills immigrants. And she will believe this as easily as you believe the story about the immigrants raping local women, because again, it plays up to her existing fears and hatreds and weaknesses. Now, if you think that people make decisions out of completely free will, you will say this is impossible. But then you are very easy prey to such manipulations.
Okay, so all of this is pretty frightening. I mean, if your crystal ball gazing is more or less accurate, what can we do? Let's talk about companies like Facebook and Google that, yep, you know, have developed these incredibly sophisticated algorithms, and they will become ever more sophisticated.
So we need to make sure, for example, that the big data algorithms are serving us, the individual people, and not serving just the interests of a corporation or a government. At present, we see more and more AI systems that are used to monitor individuals in the service of governments and corporations. But the technology itself can be used in an opposite way to monitor the corporations and the governments in the service of the individuals. We can, for example, build an AI system that monitors government officials to prevent corruption. Most of the efforts are now going in the opposite direction, in giving the government or the big corporations the ability to monitor us. But there is no technical problem in reversing the direction of the surveillance.
Mm-hmm. So you've laid out all kinds of pretty frightening scenarios for where the world might be headed. Are you more an optimist or more a pessimist about where we're headed?
I will summarize my view of the world at present in three simple statements. Things are better than ever before. Things are still quite bad, and things can get much, much worse. And this adds up, I think, to a somewhat optimistic view of the world, but there is nothing inevitable about it. Science and technology guarantee only one thing, and this thing is power. Humankind is going to become more powerful, that's for sure. But what to do with this power? Here we have all kinds of options. And if you look back in history, sometimes people use power wisely and very often they misuse their power. One of the most important forces in human history is human stupidity.
Right.
We should never underestimate human stupidity. And when you combine this limitless resource of human stupidity with the amazing new powers that humankind will gain in the 21st century, this can be a recipe for disaster.
Yuval Noah Harari, Fighting Human Stupidity One Book at a Time. His most recent is called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, and he was talking with Steve Paulson. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced every week by humans, not algorithms. Our names are Mark Rickers, Charles Monroe Kane, Shannon Henry Kleiber, Angelo Bautista, Joe Hartke, and Steve Paulson. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. No Facebook or Twitter accounts were harmed in the making of this episode, but whatever you decide to do with your own, thanks for listening.